Hello and welcome to Unearth the Past, a brand new family history and genealogy podcast brought to you by me, Dr. Michaela Hume. This week I am sharing the screen if you're watching on YouTube, or audio if you are listening to this podcast, with two very special Pauls. I couldn't think of, maybe I could think of two, maybe Paul McCartney, Paul McKenna. No, folks, this week I'm here with Paul McNeil and Paul Chiddix. Hello, lads. How are we both?
Hello, Michaela. Hello, Paul. Paul one, I should say.
Yeah, hello, Paul two.
Delighted to be here.
Have we both had a nice week? Because the sun is shining. McNeil looks like he has literally just stepped off a yacht.
I'm glowing. I've made the mistake of sitting in the garden and working. I'm absolutely red raw.
Yeah, I've got a show about you.
Nice little gloss like the paint.
If you are listening to this on Apple or wherever you get your podcast from, make sure you check out YouTube because you can actually see us. You will see the video and see what we all look like, which is great because, it's a joy, isn't it?
I've actually got a burning question for Paul, actually.
Oh, okay.
Oh yeah.
I love this. Go for it.
I've got this feeling that we might have the same barber. Do you think we've got the same barber?
Well, unless my wife cuts your hair, then no.
I'm not paying the travel money.
My missus, she shears me like a sheep once a month.
So let's start then today's podcast by going all the way back to when we first started our family trees. And there's going to be people listening who are maybe thinking about it, have never done it before. Where would you start? If you had your time again and you were starting your family tree, what would you do? Now, Chiddix, do you want to go first? Because I can see you first on the screen.
I'll go first. The one thing I do regret, and a lot of family history researchers will tell you the same, I lost all my grandparents by the time I was 21, and I never had those important conversations. I never asked them about their life, their childhood, where they worked, all the simple questions, and all that's gone now. And I'm sure there'll be loads of listeners now who will be sitting at home. We've got aunts, uncles, grandparents. Before you do any research, before you plug your computer in, before you log on to Ancestry, go and have a chat with your elderly relatives. You don't have to do anything too formal. It doesn't have to be a recording, but just try and ask them. Just have conversations, because most people, especially elderly people, they're only too grateful to have someone who's interested in their life. To have a conversation, take them to places that they, memorable places, their childhood, where they grew up. And it promotes the conversation. It gives them something to talk about. That's the one thing that sort of, I'd say probably the biggest regret. Everyone says when you start your family tree, start with you, which obviously is obviously your base point and your starting point. But before you race off, and we all want to race off. We want to go back 200 years and collect names and harvest names and grow trees. But just stop and have a chat. Talk to some people in your family and just have some conversations. That's the biggest regret I've got.
And what about you, Paul? Would you echo that?
So there are three sources that you can go to. The obvious one is the paper sources or the online sources, so written sources, and that's fine. They may or may not be true. You can get a long way back with them, and that's great. There's DNA that can take you back to the Stone Age, and it never lies. It's always right, but doesn't necessarily give you any detail. It can just answer a few questions for you. And then there's people, and it's people that give you the stories. And that's the important thing. My view is if you just build a tree, We can all do that, and you have 1,000 people on it, and you have a load of dates. Really, it's so what? I mean, you can put it up on your wall and say, look at that, you know, I go back to whoever, but everybody does. So what's important are the stories. And you'll get the stories from newspapers if your ancestors are infamous or famous, but ordinary people's stories you only get from other people. So what Paul said was absolutely true. And I'll give you an example. On my birth certificate, it names my father. My DNA said he was not, so obviously he wasn't. But to get the story, I had to find one of my cousins, Stevie, and ask him what actually happened, because he was 13 when I was born. So from the paper, I got something that wasn't true. From the DNA, I got something that was true, but with no detail. But from the people, you get the story, and it's the story that really counts. And once you go back to your grandparents, I mean, my grandparents were born in the 1880s. So you imagine their experience through the First World War, through the Second World War. And you can get bits of that from books about bombing or, you know, whatever, or what they did in the army. But you don't get any of the detail, and that's the important bit. So I'd agree, absolutely, start with people, get what you can, and then feed into it. Because sometimes you get family stories which are legends, and they grow over time. So, you know, you can check them out and see how much of it is an interesting story and how much is what definitely happened. But it all goes into the rich milieu of what you're finding out.
There's probably going to be people listening who have had a document and who do get quite a shock or quite a surprise, something that, you know, they weren't expecting. So how did you deal with that?
Well, probably the thing with me, the best thing with me was that I was 64 when I found out. So they're all dead. I mean, they're all dead by the time I was 26. So, you know, they're all gone. I found it interesting more than anything because, my dad brought me up. Mm-hmm. So there was another guy who's my biological father who I never met, never saw. After what happened, that was it. Had no other contact with the family or anything like that. So the other person means nothing other than it's quite interesting. And I've kind of tracked down the family. So I know roughly who it is from this mm-hmm. family, and I haven't gone further with them. And I'll tell you why, because, I was trying to get, a TV company to film it.
Right.
But I'm not quite famous enough. They won't do it. So I'm going to have to just do it myself. But you know, it was a shock. It was a surprise. It was surprising one way because no one said anything. I mean, they all took the secret to their graves. Mm. My mum, my dad, my brother, not a single person said anything. As I say, I've only got one cousin that's older than me left alive. He's 80. And so I phoned him up and said, look, Stevie, you know what I do and the genealogy and all that. And I've had a DNA test and I found this out. And he said, all right, Paul, let me think about it and I'll call you back. So he was mulling over what he should tell me. And 5 minutes later, his wife phoned me up, Pauline, and said, I said to him, just tell him what you know. Just get on with it. Go on. So she put him on the phone. And he said, yeah, he told me sort of, you know, the circumstances behind it. You know, mum and dad were always having problems of breaking up and going back together and all this. And it was an accident, you know. And so I sort of understood it. But because I've been doing so much genealogy, like, since the 70s, I know that, you know, 10% of births aren't to the father that's on the birth certificate, roughly, you know, on average. So it's like, oh, okay, I'm one of them then. So it just became interesting and meant I had to do another tree, you know. So I had no one to go to other than my cousin. So it was all down then to the DNA and to the paperwork and geography. Who was where when? Who could it have been? And I worked out like that. Emotionally, it didn't really affect me because my dad brought me up. And in fact, given that he knew that wasn't his, you know, because other people knew, so he must have known. And yet he still brought me up as if I was his. I mean, you know, he was in the war and all this, so he wasn't that affectionate, but he wasn't that affectionate to my brother either, so it wasn't just me. My brother was his, so, you know, it's just one of those things, and that's the way men were then. You know, they'd been off killing people, and then they came back and expected to be all nice and lovey-dovey, and they weren't, you know.
And did you have any idea growing up, like family pictures? Did you ever think, oh, I don't quite look like my dad, or did you just not?
The interesting thing was, we've all got blue-grey eyes. So me, my brother, my mum, my dad, all of us. But I was blonde when I was born. And you can probably still see. But I was blonde when I was born. And my hair
gradually... I'll get me a magnifying glass.
My hair went darker as I got to, like, my teens. My hair went darker, brown and brown and brown. But my dad was sort of Irish colouring. He had the blue-grey eyes and he had black hair. And all his brothers did, and my brother did. So the only telltale sign was I was blonde and no one else was. But apart from that, you couldn't really tell because I looked like my mum. So, although she had hair, but, you know, I looked like my mum's side of the family. So it was one of those things. But I'm absolutely convinced that all the families, brothers, my cousins, everybody knew, except for me, until I was 64. So it's like nothing you can do about it. You know, these things happen. You know, it's just one of those things. So my dad was my dad. That will never change. But just out of interest, I know I've got someone that was my biological father. So the interest to me is kind of less about him because I understand what happened and, you know, it happens. And it's more about, so what's his family story? What's the story there? Because that's another one I've got to look at. So I see myself as part of the McNeil tribe, even though genetically I'm not a McNeil. So it's the difference between a family and a tribe. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which, interestingly, brings me on to the untrue story in the family tree. So my dad always thought his ancestors were Scottish. Because, you know, it's like with working-class families, once you get beyond a grandparent, you don't know anything about them. You don't know your great-grandparents or anyone like that. They're all dead and no one talks about it. So he thought they were probably Scottish because of the name McNeil. And the name McNeil originates on the island of Barra in the Outer Hebrides. So for my, I think it was my, might be my 40th birthday, my missus booked for me and her and my two boys all to fly up to the island of Barra in the Outer Hebrides. Because we got over there, we had a great time. Everyone's called McNeil. So it was just fantastic, you know. But I thought, while I'm here, I'll have a look through some of the parish records. So they're all Catholics up there. So I go to the village priest, have a chat with him. Look, this is who I am. I'm from London. You know, name's McNeil, blah, 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 blah. He said, oh, yeah, come in. He said, you can go through all the records and everything. Of course, you get all the records out. McNeil, 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 McNeil. It's like impossible, absolutely impossible. But we have a wonderful time. Apart from the weather, which is horrible up there, but the beaches are like the Caribbean. The people are lovely. There's one circular road that goes around the whole island. The local bloke, John McNeil, took us out on his boat, took us to Kishmoel Castle. The piratical Lords of McNeil lived in there. And we had a fantastic time. You know, people really sort of took us in and that. Came all the way back. Years later, when I actually looked into my dad's family, they were Irish from County Kerry. That had nothing to do with Scotland at all. So not only was it my dad, but I'd actually been to Barra and been to the wrong place when I could have gone to County Kerry. What can you do, eh?
Well, I'm glad they had a nice trip to Scotland anyway.
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious. Sorry to interrupt the podcast. Just a quick note from me. If you are enjoying it and you would like to help support the making of this podcast, please visit my Patreon account, and that's www.patreon.com/Dr. Michaela Hume. If you are listening to this podcast, please remember to download. And if you are watching it on YouTube, please remember to like and subscribe. That way you'll be kept informed every time I release a new episode. Now back to the podcast.
Have you had any cousin matches come through then on your paternal side?
That's what gave me the story. So my mother's maiden name was Locke, and I was getting all the kids coming in from Locks and Kimbers, all that side of the family, and I could see them. Yeah. I thought, right, that's how they all fit in. I can understand all of this. But nothing was coming in from the McNeil side. There were no McNeils, no Trimmers, no one, no Earlys. None of the people I knew should be in the tree were coming up. And I thought, okay, so if you don't get many, it could be that people just haven't bought DNA tests. And that happens, you know, but none. And it's like, this is wrong. And then I've got an absolute tranche of names coming up. I won't say the family name, but for one particular family name. And I thought, well, all these hits that are coming up really should be McNeils, but they're not. So I did their family tree on my own. You know, I'm a genealogist. So I actually traced their family tree and put it together. And the only connection was they lived in Deptford, near to where my mum and dad were living. And it's like, okay, so this must be the connection. And it was from that I worked out who they were. Then I spoke to my cousin. Then the bits fell into place and it all started to make sense, you know. So yes, basically I've got three family trees. I've got the Locks, I've got the McNeils, and I've got this other family going up to be revealed if I ever get a contract to do it on the TV.
What about you, Paul? Have you had anything surprising in a record or in your family tree that maybe you weren't expecting?
There was a story that I, not a story, but when I first started researching, got to my great-grandparents, did what everyone does, looked at their marriage, found their marriage, counted 9 months forward, and started collecting the children. With my name, Chiddix, it was dead easy. Anyone born in my neighbourhood, got to be mine. Collected all the births, marriages and death certificates that I needed. That was it, job done. Then about 10 years later, I thought I'm going to harvest all the Chiddix names from the BMDs. Went through the lot. They've got everyone, listed them all. Then there was found this unusual one, Louisa Annie Chiddix. Born right where she should be, right in my neck of the woods. Didn't have a clue who she was. Absolutely no idea. So I thought, well, okay. Can't resist the temptation. I'll have to order the birth certificate. So I ordered the birth certificate, and there was a death certificate, sadly, just 2 months later. She was my granddad's oldest sister. Obviously, she only survived 2 months. And if you do the maths, they got married in the April, I think it was, and she was born in the September. So you don't need to be a genius to calculate that. Yeah, she was born way before they actually walked down the aisle. So it was a surprise, and the certificate and finding that was something that wasn't expected. But, of course, it was a fatal schoolboy error, an own goal, really, trying to be methodical. Let's do it logical. Let's move 9 months forward. Yeah, families don't work like that. Family history doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't. I've done the family tree of a Hollywood actor whose name shall remain anonymous, but he's a very successful Hollywood A-lister. And I did his family tree. And when I looked into it, his surname, again, a bit like sort of what you had, McNeil, when you did your research, but his surname shouldn't be the surname that he's using. Yeah. Because if you actually go back, you'll find that, you know, I think it's his great, 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 great grandmother had a child out of wedlock and just kept her maiden name. And then that sort of had passed down. But obviously, you know, traditionally, you know, you take your father's name, don't you? So I'm always thinking, I wonder if he knows.
That's the thing, you can put what you like on a certificate.
Yeah.
Don't actually have to prove it. If you're the informant, you can say whatever you want within reason.
How have you guys found certificates in general? Like ages, have your ages been way out? I mean, I've had eight years out on one of them. I'm thinking, how can that even be? It was like late Victorian as well. It wasn't that old. And I always say that to my students when they're researching. My students are like, you know, real sticklers for the date on a census. And I'm like, you have to go You have to go at least 5 years either side. People had no idea when they were born. Have you guys found that as well? Are your Absolutely. Ancestors like mine and they just got no idea when they were born?
I think the thing that always sticks with me is most people remember their birthday. So if they say their birthday is the 30th of June, the year could be any year. I mean, literally, I think the longest one, I think, was 12 years. I've estimated the time difference. But normally, the date is actually correct or virtually correct. But the year just gets lost along the way. Sometimes, of course, genuinely lost. Sometimes fabricated for, shall we say, dodgy reasons, or maybe they wanted to get enlisted in the army, so they bring their age forward to serve, say, in World War One. So there's always a genuine reason and also potentially a misleading reason for a named an age change.
I'll tell you something, and it's going to make me really unpopular with probably half of the audience. You go to the census and you see the couples, and the man keeps the same age, or, you know, it goes up 10 years every census. And I found multiple examples where the woman loses a year every census.
So you're getting sounds older, like you.
But at a much slower rate than her husband is. And I find that a lot. And I'm just the messenger. Don't shoot me. But that's what I find.
Can I just say that does sound like my life? Like when people say, how old are you? I'm like, mid-30s. Yeah, mid-30s.
What am I laughing? But what Paul said was right. A lot of people just didn't know when they were born. They didn't know the year. And if you can't read and write, you know, if you can just about put across for your name, you know, you don't know.
In terms of both of your family trees, and we'll start with you, Chidick. So let's start with your family tree. What is the furthest your ancestors have travelled from?
Well, that's a funny story. That's one of my round the pub stories, because if you go back on my direct mail line, you've got my dad, Frank Chiddicks, his dad, Horace Chiddicks. Now, my granddad, he only ever worked within a bike ride in his entire life of his house. Lived in the same house for 55 years, and wherever he worked was within a push bike's ride of that house. His dad never moved again. His dad never moved again. So from 1761 until I moved to Cheshire, I'm the first one. I'm the first export from Essex who's left the county. So beat that one.
That's incredible.
Wow. What about you, McNeil? How far have your ancestors travelled?
Well, as far as they can go, basically Australia. So,
okay.
And I'll tell you a story about that. As far as I'm aware, my nan is the only person I've ever heard of to be criminally deported from Australia.
Reverse deportation.
I know. How does that even happen?
Her family went over in 1908, right? Mm. And she didn't, because she was married. So the mum and dad, it was chimney sweep. I mean, big long story to do with that. He broke into a workhouse and got the kids out and his girlfriend effectively out and took them away and went to South London. These were the Trimmers, family called the Trimmers. Anyway, 1908, they went to Australia and they did well out there. They did really well. And got in touch with my nan, who had stayed because she was married to a bloke. Turned out to be an army deserter before she married my granddad. So this is my dad's family as opposed to my father's family. Yeah. And said, well, why don't you come out here? And some of the family went and stayed out there, my Uncle Sid and a few others. But this would have been just after the war. They all come back from the war. You know, England's in a state. There was no money. There's still rationing. And they were getting letters from Australia saying, well, it's lovely out here. Look, we're all down on the beach and all the rest of it. So it's like, well, why not? You know, £10 poms. It was that. Mm. So anyway, she went out there. And so part of the family went out there and she went out there. I don't know on what basis she went there. But she went there on some strange basis, and she didn't have any right of residency or anything like that. And she was basically outstaying her welcome in the country. And I'm not sure what went on, but I've got this picture of her on some big P&O liner coming home again with a great big hat on, where she'd been deported from the country and come back again. So as far as I'm aware, she's the only person that's ever been deported from Australia, from back to England.
My great-grandfather went to Australia. We think he was committing insurance fraud over here in Stockport. When the insurance man used to come round and knock on your door in an evening and take your money, he memorised the route that the insurance person took and went round an hour before and basically took all the money. And then when he was in Australia, he committed a load of heinous crimes, murder, you name it, he did it, and they hung him. I know it sounds very strange. I'm very detached from it because obviously I didn't know him. My dad didn't know him. My granddad had never met him because my granddad was 3 when he left for Australia. His mum, her birth certificate says she was born over Spanish waters. Yeah. I don't know what that means, but it sounds great. I have since done my DNA and there's no Spanish in it. But born over Spanish waters sounds lovely.
Could be anywhere. Could be on the way to Brazil or Portugal or anywhere. Yeah, literally anywhere.
Literally anywhere.
Sounds very exotic.
Sounds like a birth at sea, doesn't it?
That's definitely a birth at sea by the sounds of it.
Yeah, definitely. We mentioned about speaking to relatives. Yeah, and I would also say at this point, make sure you make good notes. Good notes are really important, and you can do that on your computer if you want. I know some people have like a journal and they handwrite everything in, but make sure you keep good notes because I guarantee you will need those notes further down the line when you come to actually putting your tree together. In terms of actually building your tree, so you've found out all this information, you've spoke to your relatives, and now you want to start putting the tree together. Now, I'm pretty old school, so I think when I started, and even now with some trees, I handwrite them just to get me going. I've got quite a big pad. It's like an art pad that I'll put the tree in. Do you guys use that? And I'll start with you, McNeil, or do you use software? Do you just upload them all on? Do you just do it straight onto your computer?
It depends. If I'm talking to somebody, like a client on the telephone, I'll write it down and I'll make extensive notes, lots and lots and lots of notes. If you're with someone face to face, I'd say if they're happy to, record it.
So yeah, definitely.
Because, in a day you've forgotten half of it and in a week you've forgotten most of it. So record it if you can. But if I'm on the phone, it'll be, I'll write it down. But then what I do is try and dump it all into, in my case, I would generally put it into an ancestry tree straight away. And don't worry if it's right or not. Just get it in there and worry about the detail afterwards. And actually use the tree to test things out if you're not quite sure, if you're not quite sure of dates or whatever. Just try and get everything down and put it somewhere where it's safe. So it's great to do notes, but really, you want it in a tree, so you've got something to remind you of what you should be doing and put the notes in the tree. So I would tend to do that. But if you talk to someone face-to-face, if you can, record it. That's the whole thing. You can forget so much, and somebody will give you an interesting bit of information, and you'll get really excited, and you'll home in on that, and you'll forget to write down something that is less interesting but might be crucial later on. And the other thing, and you see it a lot, people try and get dates out of people, ask people specifically for dates or a geographic area or what somebody did for a living or what they went, where do they go to school? Little hints like that help you to build a picture. So try and field as much as the background as you can. People don't like to do it. They like to just let people talk, and that's fine. But you need to get some detail in there as well. What do you think, Paul?
I'd agree with that. And I'd add to that as well, especially if you're doing an individual at the start, build a timeline. Because a timeline for that individual clearly and quickly shows you what's missing. You know, they'll show you a gap. You've got a 10-year gap. You've missed the census. You know, you've got a birth, no marriage, and there's children. So it quickly gives you a picture of the missing bits that you can go back and add to the picture. But definitely throw it into a tree. I always throw it into a tree. But then I always have a handwritten timeline for each individual. So I've got something to go back to, see where the gaps are, and then go back into the tree and then look for the bits that are missing.
Yeah. I think the other thing is a lot of people, if they're on an online system, you know, Find My Past, Ancestry or whatever, I think a lot of people are worried about putting things in there unless they know they're absolutely 100%. And actually, you don't owe anyone anything when you're building that tree except for yourself. So it's a matter of putting anything in that you can and using it as a tool. You know, you get people complaining, oh, you know, there's wrong dates in this tree and that tree and all that. But they're works in progress. All of them are. You know, you never quite know. So I would say, you know, build a tree, build it out, change it, do whatever you have to do, and build a new tree if you need to. And also keep a copy locally. So if you're going to do this online, make sure you've got a program on your PC, your tablet, whatever. So you've got a copy that when you're sitting on the train and you can't get a signal, you can play around with it and do something and then synchronize them.
So just to finish then, I thought we could play a quick game. I'm going to give you like either or, and I just want you to say what you prefer and why. Feel free to say both, or if you've got a story connected to what I'm saying, please feel free to share that story. Let's start with you, Paul McNeil. So Find My Past, Ancestry, or both?
I use both. I mean, no question. If I could only use one, I'd probably use Ancestry because I prefer the front end. I think it's a bit more user-friendly and it's got a huge database behind it. But I subscribe to both and I use both. Apart from anything else, cross-referencing. You know, and different people have done the transcriptions of different records. So sometimes you can't find a record in one, you can in the other. If I can't find someone in a census, I immediately go to the other system, no matter which one I'm on, and do another search in there and see if it comes up. And 9 times out of 10, it will. Not always, but quite often it will.
And what about you, Paul Chiddix? What do you think? Have you got a favourite search engine that you use the most?
I'm a bit like Paul, really. I've used Ancestry from the beginning, so they're like a comfy pair of slippers. But I do also subscribe to Find My Past, of course, for the newspapers. You need them for the newspapers. But like Paul said, you can mix and match between search engines. You might put one set of search parameters in one, hit nothing, put it in the other one, and you'll get a result. Plus, as well, the image quality. There can be vast differences in the image quality. Shouldn't be, but there are. You know, you can pick up an 1851 census and it's really patchy on Ancestry, but it's a lot sharper on Find My Past. It's difficult if you've got a limited budget and you can only have one or the other. But I like Find My Past from the newspapers and Ancestry because it also syncs with my software as well.
Okay, so next one, moving on then. What do you prefer, a birth certificate or a death certificate? And I'll start with you, Paul Chiddix.
I'm going to buck the trend. I'm going to go for a death certificate.
Ooh, why?
Primarily because we don't kill off enough of our ancestors. Sorry about that for anyone listening. We tend to have these gaps in our trees where we think, well, what information is a death certificate going to give us? You know, is there going to be any information on there? Of course, you don't know who the informant is until you get the death certificate. The informant could be an in-law that you don't know about, a future in-law that you don't know about. And also, if you've got common ancestors with common names, I think I've got 14 Thomas Wootons on my tree.
Wow.
If you're trying to eliminate one from another, you'd need a death certificate to kill a few off. So I'm gonna go with death certificates.
McNeil?
I'd probably agree with you, and I'll tell you why. I just think it's easier to find birth certificates if you know a mother's maiden name. It's that much easier to get one. With a death certificate, all you've got is a name and you know roughly when they were born. if somebody dies and they die in the workhouse, or they're, you know, they don't have a relative that's a witness, the age might be a guess. So it's actually a lot more difficult often to find a death certificate than to find a birth certificate. So I'd feel more confident in being able to find a birth certificate myself, whereas if somebody could just give me a death certificate, that's probably saved me a lot of time.
Okay, moving on to the next one. I'm going to start with you now, Paul McNeil. The 1939 register or the 1911 census? I can see them both thinking. I've obviously stumped them with this one, folks.
I like the 1939 register, but it's got a lot less information in it, of basic information. So you've got a birth date, you've got a name, you see a part of the family, but you don't necessarily know where they're born. You might pick up a bit of information about whether they were an ARP warden or something like that. So that's quite good. I like that. The other thing is a lot of people are missing from it. So a lot of men that are in the army, they're not on there. You know, people didn't want to keep a ledger of where the soldiers were and where they were based and all this kind of thing, because we were going to war and everybody knew it. So there's a lot of information that isn't on there. The good thing about it is it gives you, if children have been evacuated, depending on how old the children were, and they're not blanked out, then you can find where they've gone to. So you find another bit of the story. So that's good. 1911 is a standard. I'd rather probably add the 1921 census and the 1939 register. But between the 1911 and 1939, I tell you what, I would go for the 1939, because I can get the 1901 census and I can get the 1921 census and probably work out the bits in between. But on that basis, for 1911, I'd go for 1939.
So you'd forego knowing how many rooms is in the house and if you had any of those little cheeky people that were born in between a census that disappear by the next census, you wouldn't be a bit curious. What about you, Paul Chiddix?
Well, I was so tempted by the 1939 register, purely because it's the closest one that we're ever going to see in our timeline. And really, it's, I think tracing ancestors or living people is much harder than tracing people perhaps 200 years ago. Yeah. So it bridges a nice gap. Obviously, we've got no 1941 or 31 census. So it does bridge a nice gap. But then when you start looking at the 1911 census, it's the first one that's in their own handwriting. Mm. It lists children that have died. So you can trace missing ones, as you say, if they drop through the gap, the 10-year gap. You can say, okay, we've had 7 children, 5 are living, but 2 have died. So let's go back and look in the indexes and try and find those missing ones. So although I probably use the 1939 one a lot more recently due to the old Palace School project, the 1911, I think, just edges it for me.
Mm. Right, okay, last one. I'm going to start with you, Paul Chiddix. So DNA tests, or archival research? In other words, paper records or DNA tests? You can only do one.
DNA test all day long, because it never lies. DNA never lies. You can have as many documents on your shelf, and I've got binders and folders. And similar to Paul's DNA journey or DNA story earlier on, I had a similar thing with my DNA, but back a further generation. So it doesn't matter what's on the paper trail, the DNA doesn't lie. So if I had to choose one, it would be the DNA test, because it proves and disproves a paper theory. You can have as much theory, as much evidence and documentation, but the DNA never lies.
What about you, McNeil? What do you think?
That's a tough one, really.
Hold on a second. I can go back, because you said we can have both, didn't you?
You could, yeah. If you
I missed that. Well, you have one and I'll have the other one, Paul. And then we'll swap notes.
Well, as we're almost twins, we should be able to corroborate them anyway.
Yeah. I think it's hard. I think that's hard, because it's true. DNA never lies, and paper obviously does, as we found out, and people do. So there's no getting away from that. But DNA, it gives you a great window into a long time ago. And the further back you go, the more it kind of tells you, almost, because you're going back to fewer and fewer people. Yeah, although we have twice as many ancestors each generation, actually, if you go back 20 generations, you'd be descended from more people than are alive in the UK today. So it doesn't work. So people are inbred, if you like. You know, there's a lot of crossover from, you know, people living in the same village, marrying their cousins and all this. So you tend to go back and it brings you in a vector to the Balkans or to Anatolia or to South Africa or wherever it might be. So it's lovely from that point of view. Romantically, I think it's great to set a story going back to the Stone Age. But then again, the paper trail, it's going to be true for some people and it's going to be true for most of the people in the tree. So there may be exceptions, and that may be me or it may be you, but most of that story for that family, whatever that surname or maiden name or whatever your following is, that story will still be true. And you don't see that with the DNA. You find the absolute truth, but you don't see the story. And you may see more of the story with the paper. The only thing is, it may not be true for everyone in that story. So I'll let go.
Yeah, with my research, DNA has really revolutionised it. So I do a lot of, and I do these cases for free, but a lot of people come to me who are adopted. And I help them find their birth parents. And DNA has really helped with that. And sometimes it's not always possible for me working with them to give them a name, because, you know, the DNA necessarily doesn't give you a name. But it will give me a short list for who it could potentially be. And I worked on a case only a couple of months ago where I'd managed to find this guy's birth mother. It was quite straightforward, but the dad wasn't. That was a bit more complicated. And we had to just sort of bide our time and wait for somebody to take a DNA test who was just a bit closer. And then, thank goodness, we managed to find out who he was. Sadly, he had passed away, but we did manage to find him. So it has definitely sort of revolutionised, I think, the research and made it easier, I think, for people who don't know who the parents are. But I like detail and I'm nosy. So I love a record. I love a Victorian sensationalised newspaper article.
Yeah.
I'm here for that. I love it.
You can't beat touching history. It's priceless. Priceless. Yeah.
So last question to you both, and I can't remember who I asked first. I'll start with McNeil because you're next to me on the screen. And I want a name. If you could invite for dinner one person from your family tree, and it could be anybody in your family tree, and you could invite them for dinner tonight, who would it be and why?
I think the obvious one would be my dad or my father, for them to tell me what they didn't tell me when they were alive, you know, all those years ago. But there's another one. There's my, I think it's about my four times great-grandfather on my mother's side. And he started, if you like, the downfall of the family. So at 15, he nicked a book from a doctor who he was a servant for. So he ran errands for him. And he stole a book from him, which implies to me he could probably read. They were in South London. And he nicked this book and he got put in Wandsworth Prison for it. And when he came out, he couldn't get any work, so he had to become a dustman. And he was a dustman in the Old Kent Road. And there were a line of dustmen going through the family until the First World War when they joined the army instead. So I'd love to get his story about, did he nick the book so he could sell it? Did he steal the book because he wanted to read it? You know, what was that story, that one thing he did wrong? It's a minor offence, but it changed the life of the whole family for generations. He went from someone who could have had probably a good living. He could have been sponsored by this doctor. You see these things all the time. You know, he went from that to being in prison for 6 months and then coming out and getting a job as a dustman because that's the only thing he could find. and the whole family carried on in South London for another 100 years at the most basic level of employment other than being in the army. My grandfather couldn't read and write, and he was 20 years in the army. So, you know, it's that all stems, in my mind, from this one mistake that this kid made at 15. So that'd be interesting, I think.
What about you, Paul Chiddick?
I'd probably go for my four times great-grandfather, Samuel Chiddick's, one I mentioned earlier, born in 1761. Where he was born, I have absolutely no idea. We're all centred in a tiny hamlet in Essex. Now, I've taken an autosomal DNA test and I've taken a Y-DNA test. And the Y-DNA test points towards Northern Ireland as the origins and America. But whether it's America to Ireland and Ireland to America, which way round that is I've not been able to sort. But how and why he would then end up in the tiniest little pocket village in Essex, I have absolutely no idea. So I'd go down the pub, have a few beers with him, and say, listen, mate, where did you come from? Where did you land from? And why did you end up there? You know, he's got to travel right across to England. You know, I just don't understand how he's gone from Northern Ireland all the way over to the east corner of Essex. If you look at my autosomal DNA, I couldn't be any more southeast England if I tried. But where he comes from, God only knows.
Thank you so much, the two Pauls, for being on this podcast. If you are interested and you would like to contact either Paul McNeil or Paul Chiddick, I shall put all their details in the description below of their website so you can contact them. You might have a question to do with your family history. I'm sure they would be interested. They will help you answer it.
Delighted, absolutely.
Thank you so much, lads, for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Been a pleasure, absolute pleasure.
Been wonderful as always, Michaela.
Fab, I'm off to Wales tonight. I'm going to go and spend the weekend in my little caravan, and I shall be back on Monday when this shall blog will be out.
I leave you with a little ABC guide before I go?
Please.
Accept nothing, believe nobody, check everything.
Have a great week, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Bye. Cheerio. Bye-bye.
Huge thanks again to my two guests from DNA Journey, Paul McNeil, and from Family Tree magazine, Paul Chiddick. Don't forget, if you enjoyed this podcast, please like and subscribe. And if you are listening to it via your usual podcast stations, please remember to download. Until next week, goodbye.